The Pharmaceutical Crime Podcast is brought to you by the Partnership for Safe Medicines, a nonprofit coalition of organizations focused on the safety of our drug supply. Learn more at safemedicines.org. And now, on to our episode.
This podcast was recorded at 1 p.m. on Friday, April 19th. A few hours later, NBC News reported that the CDC has announced that three more people in two new states have experienced harmful reactions to counterfeit or mishandled Botox injections. Our discussion is even more relevant as the case unfolds. Please take a listen. All right, today we're recording an emergency podcast on news that the FDA has found counterfeit Botox in multiple states. On April 12th, it was reported that 19 people across nine states reported harmful reactions after Botox injections, according to the FDA, and the investigation has spread to nine states. Patients who've experienced adverse events from these counterfeit injections have had botulism symptoms including blurred or double vision, droopy face, fatigue, shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, and hoarse voice. The CDC and the FDA are both currently investigating, and the FDA reports that these incidents have occurred when counterfeit Botox is injected by licensed and unlicensed individuals and/or in non-medical or unlicensed settings. However, the products, they confirm, were purchased from unlicensed sources. Discussing this new development with me today are two of PSM's board members, Ron Bone and Sam Lewis. Ron is an expert in pharmaceutical traceability with over 40 years of experience in the pharmaceutical wholesale industry. Counselor Sam Lewis, a litigation attorney in Holland and Knight, has over his 32-year career handled many complex white-collar crime cases, some as the former deputy criminal chief of the program fraud group for the U.S. Department of Justice in the Southern District of Texas, where he oversaw a healthcare fraud task force and a global anti-counterfeiting task force. No one knows more about counterfeit prosecutions for the Department of Justice than Sam. Sam, Ron, welcome to the Pharmaceutical Crime Podcast. Let's start by what's known in this case, right? We know that the FDA and the CDC are investigating. We know they're working with a legitimate manufacturer, but we also know that these products are not legitimate product, right? They have all these telltale signs of not legitimate product. I'll get to that in a second. They've been used by both licensed and unlicensed professionals, and some of the injections are given in a non-medical setting, not in a doctor's office. And they seem pretty sure they were purchased from unlicensed sources, which is likely because if you look at the pictures of the product, there's no serial number on them. There's no scannable data matrix. There's no GTIN. I mean, Ron, you've got 40 years of experience in wholesaling and you know the DSCSA. Like, is a medicine like that even surviving 5 feet past the front door in a licensed wholesaler?
No, and unfortunately, what we found is people actually know they don't have a good product. I mean, we have the example of the Roche product in California was it's Genentech in the United States. And so if you have something that's not Genentech, then it's not the right product. And these people are, these were doctor offices. And so they knew they didn't have the right thing.
Yeah. And if you look at the box, it's pretty obvious. Like there's no, like, I know Ron, you know, Ron and Sam especially, you've been in this a long time, but like, can there be any other telltale sign of a counterfeit if the box has writing that's in, you know, not English?
Well, yeah, as Ron just pointed out, you know, if a doctor receives this and he's taking, first of all, he has to take inventory. So when you take inventory, well, you need to write down a lot number and a serial number. So that's what stands out, right? If you are concerned about making sure you only have a legitimate product.
Yeah. And I was, you know, one of the things I love about counterfeits is when they screw up something super obvious that's checkable. I mean, putting writing in another language, in this case, the boxes and the vials have Turkish and a dialect of Chinese on them. But my very, 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 very favorite is when they do things like they use a dose that isn't approved in the country that you're administering it in. So these vials are labeled, the carton and vial is labeled 150 unit doses, which is not one made by AbbVie or Allergan. We had something similar in Canada where there was a counterfeit of tebuoxycosid that contained fentanyl, which is, you know, alone in it, that's very deadly. But they were selling it in these wholesale size bottles of like 1,000 pills, and no 1,000 pill bottle of that product existed in the Canadian healthcare system. So everybody that got it had to know, right? Like, no computer system was going to check it incorrectly. No pharmacist had ever seen it before. That stuff is just completely and obviously super fake.
Yep.
Sam, you've actually had some experience prosecuting a Botox counterfeiter. Tell me about that case.
So it's interesting. That case was investigated in 2007, and the prosecution of that case was 2009-2010. So you would think by now, here we are 2024, we would not be talking about counterfeit Botox. But that circumstance was where legitimate doctors, who at that time, Allergan had a very tight, secure chain, supply chain on Botox, and you could only get it from Allergan. So clearly, if a doctor had something that didn't come from Allergan and had on the packaging, not for human use, for research purposes only, that would say what? That's not an authentic product. And in that case, that's what the doctor was injecting into patients, but having them sign consent forms indicating that they were receiving authentic Botox.
Oh my gosh. Well, we just had a case here in the Northern District of California of a physician who was knowingly buying from unlicensed sources. In some cases, the boxes did not have lot numbers that had ever been used, so it was clearly counterfeit, but this doctor also knew. And it was really, really interesting to see the pre-sentencing memo for this particular case, and she ended up pleading guilty to a misdemeanor, and her practice pleading guilty to a felony was, it detailed all the work that they went to hide the boxes that they got from the unlicensed internet sellers from the actual drug manufacturer salesman who came by her office.
My God.
Well, I'll tell you a quick story. This case is long old, so it was a doctor by the name of Gail Rothenberg. But there was a, this product was sent out to various states. And if I recall correctly, it was in Florida. A couple, a doctor and his wife, were injecting themselves, and they almost became paralyzed. They had to go to the hospital. And so luckily they recovered, but they did fess up and say that they had gotten this product, not from Allergan. So once they said how they got the product, then the Food and Drug Administration sent leads out to all these field offices after they had got these invoices showing who had purchased this product. So they went to the doctor's office and asked him if they had any. And the doctor initially said, well, we have a little bit, but we use it on our family and friends tested out, and we never use it on patients. Well, that was before the agents had the invoices. Once they had the invoices, and they also got invoices from Allergan showing for the same time period that there were little to no purchases from Allergan, I requested the agent to go back, and this time to investigate the husband and wife separately, because the husband was a lawyer. And I was concerned that the doctor was going to say she used this based on advice of counsel. And so I had them interview them separately, and to let them know that they'd given a false statement, which was a 1001 violation, and they had to come clean. And they actually did. The husband came clean first. And by that time, he was able to go to the wife and said, look, he's already told us, you're going to make it worse if you lie any further. And so they did admit, but we ended up still going to trial because she was still saying, well, this didn't hurt anybody, and she really thought it was a good product.
You know, I'm actually fascinated by that defense, because I feel that, you know, at the point at which I, as a patient, am being exposed to a medicine or a substance that I didn't consent to, that hasn't been reviewed by the FDA, and the doctor doesn't really even know what it is, at that point, I have been harmed. Even if I don't fall over dead or my arm falls off or my face freezes up, I have been harmed at that point because I, you know, no, who knows what could have happened. Like if you rob a bank and fail to get any money, that doesn't mean you aren't guilty of robbing a bank.
Right.
That's true. You didn't know, it doesn't have to be the worst case scenario for an outcome.
Yeah. So I do want to tell everybody that there are photos from the FDA's alert on our website of the fake product. You can find it. It's pretty obvious. You don't need photos to identify it if you actually are familiar with any medicine in the U.S. that's been regulated by the FDA. You'll see some problems, like I said, like foreign writing on it and a lack of the DSCSA information. Sarah highlighted for me a photo of the vial that seems to lack periods in the sentences. Well, let me timestamp when we're recording this. It's Friday, April 19th, 2024 at 1 p.m. Pacific. If you're listening to this more than a week after, I suspect it'll be more than the 9 states that the investigation has expanded to, because that's just kind of how things work in our global economy. And we actually don't know a lot yet, but let me actually ask you, Ron, it's not a patient, the Drug Supply Chain Security Act is not a patient-facing security system. It's for supply chain participants. Can you describe how a normal vial of medicine, it doesn't have to be Botox, but a normal vial of medicine moves through the supply chain to the pharmacy? And what is the system, what is the Drug Supply Chain Act Security Act do to protect it?
Right. And let me start with a, because this was monumental that the United States Congress did, that the 113th Congress passed the Drug Supply Chain Security Act. We call it the DSCSA. And President Obama signed it in 2013. And we had 10 years as an industry. This will tell you how complex this is that we're accomplishing here. 10 years to put this in place. But what this required is that the drug manufacturers have to apply a unique number on every single bottle. This is down to the pill bottle level or other packaging, but right at one bottle at a time, they have to put this unique number on there. That's a scannable number that now flows through the supply chain. And the purpose of this number is to allow us within the supply chain to identify every company that has ever had possession of this product. And we can do that now because we're not at lot number, which are thousands of items, but we're now at each individual unit of product. And every manufacturer, repackager, wholesale, and third-party distributor, plus all the dispensers, must meet requirements to be designated as an authorized trading partner. And this is new. I mean, that means they have a license, and that's the only people that we're allowed to do business with within the new law that's been put in place.
And I think I know this, Ron, from my read of the statute, which is that at the moment at which someone in the supply chain, let's say if a physician or a nurse bought this product from an unlicensed seller and bought product without product identifiers, they basically committed two violations of the Drug Supply Chain Security Act, right?
That's what they've done. Correct.
Yeah.
And what happens is they're not getting the information that's required to be in there because we now have transaction histories, transaction information and statements, all forms that say, here's where the product has been, here's the information about the product. And actually, when the, let's say a wholesaler is ordering it, they order that item specifically and expect to see those pieces of information coming back. And more importantly, they expect to get this identifier that's unique to that package.
And it's interesting, like the having nothing, having no serial number of the package ought to be a red flag. But I guess what we've got here are individuals. I don't know if they're physicians, although I will tell you, PSM has a number of publications on our site about physicians who've broken the supply chain for personal financial gain in the area of IUDs, oncology medicines, and Botox. you know, at that point at which you decide that you're going to just throw everything out the window, there's some hope, I suppose, in your mind that you're not going to get caught because you're not involving any of the licensed wholesalers. But clearly, when people get hurt, you're probably going to get caught.
Yes, and if part of their business is licensed and there's inspectors coming in, this product is going to be found. So, you can't avoid, the inspectors have a tool that they never had before. And so now the inspection is very important. And if you don't follow the rules, you lose your license.
Now, Ron, you've been in your 40 years, I'm sure you've been had a front seat to recalls that were done for medicine. But in this case, the FDA hasn't called a recall because I think it's pretty clear that it won't retrieve anything, right? This isn't valid product. It's not mixed in with valid product. There's nothing.
That's correct. And that makes this very challenging. I mean, there's two kinds of recalls. One would be from the manufacturer themselves saying they've been identified with a problem with their item, maybe the FDA, or even it could be from one of the people down the supply chain, and they initiate a recall. There could also be recalls from the FDA. Those are the two types of recalls that we get. But the recall now is going to be very specific because we're doing this not by lot numbers, but we're doing by serial numbers. So this, when you have a package like you described with the Botox, no serial number on it, people should look at that and say, if nothing else, you can never even do a recall on this item.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's why we just have pictures of, a box and a vial that looks like nothing real, because that's all you can do to get it out of the system. Before we go on, and I want to talk to Sam here in a minute, but I want to just ask one last question. You know, I feel like PSM has done a lot of research around prosecutions of people who break the supply chain. And I'm not going to say that pharmacists never break the supply chain, because every profession has a couple bad apples, but it's not usually a pharmacist prosecution that we write up at PSM. It's typically patients who break the supply chain. That's the largest problem. And then it's doctors. Doctors are, you know, we don't see major, certainly not prime wholesalers breaking the supply chain. And when I think about this, I think about, you know, the risk, and the person who is most likely breaking it here is either someone who's minimally licensed, maybe an unlicensed Botox nurse, or not even a nurse, or maybe it's a physician, but it seems reckless for a physician to do this. But Sam, I think you probably prosecuted a number of physicians in your career.
So I hate to break it to you, but in my prior life as a prosecutor with the Department of Justice, I prosecuted pharmacists, doctors, dispensers, secondary wholesalers, and those at the retail level, all of them involving counterfeit. And of course, what's the main ingredient, as Ron just said, unfortunately, is greed. It's putting finances over somebody's safety.
Yeah. Now, Ron, based upon your understanding of, you know, pharmacy procedures and, you know, check-in procedures, I know you've got pharmacy in your family, and of course, as a wholesaler to pharmacies, you've spent your lifetime working with them. Does it seem likely to you that these vials ever pass through the hands of a legitimate pharmacist who wasn't part of a crime? Like, is it even possible to, it's not possible to check in this vial into an inventory system, is it?
No, you would not. And so because you're not checking it in, you know, it's not legitimate supply chain. So, you know, you bought it from non-legitimate supply chain, and you should know you're putting people at risk as soon as you do that, because it didn't come through the vetted system for products to flow. It's unconscionable that people do this.
Yeah. So Sam, there was something really interesting about this, and this gets to my question of how these cases actually reach the law enforcement that begins to investigate them. But as we heard before, it's both the FDA and the CDC investigating, or at least who are talking about, you know, monitoring this case. Do you think that's because what was spotted first was a number of people across different states having a similar medical adverse event with similar symptoms, and it's possible the CDC thought what we have maybe here is some kind of viral outbreak or some kind of beginning of a small pandemic, until they figured out that the common link was fake Botox.
Well, you know, the CDC may have concerns about whether it's an authentic product, but there's some type of ingredient in there that may be causing a problem with a bad batch. So that has happened before, and the CDC has investigated and worked with the manufacturer to identify, you know, what's causing it, so they can quarantine that, but trace it and quarantine that particular lot. But once they determine, as has been reported, that some of these outbreaks was a result of a non-medical procedure, then, you know, that kind of has a pattern that's emerged over the years, where individuals go to what I used to call these Botox parties, or these facilities, and they really don't know the source of the product that they're about to be or receiving injections from. And so that's where, of course, FDA's Office of Criminal Investigation and the Homeland Security, HSI, has, you know, immense experience in investigating those type cases. And my experience is that a lot of times when the agents would go and talk to the actual person, the consumer who's receiving this, a lot of times they ask them, why did you take this product, and it didn't come from a pharmacist, didn't come from a retail store or doctor, the prescription? And they would say, well, you know, and I believe that the pharmaceutical industry jacks up the price and hypes it up. And so I really thought that this was the same product, but I was cutting out the middleman. And so I used to hear that more and more, and until, you know, only through education do the public understand that they're putting themselves at serious risk when they don't ensure that they receive a pharmaceutical product through the legitimate supply chain from a licensed person who's authorized to dispense it.
Yeah. So I have a question. I have a question about how these cases sort of end up in the lap of the FDA, right? If someone ends up in the hospital, or if multiple someone's ends up in the hospital, I understand, you know, that there is, and for the sake of our audience, a medical adverse event reporting system that healthcare professionals might use when they figure out that there was maybe the patient said, I got this Botox and then I got sick and I couldn't move my face anymore. You know, or I had trouble breathing. When that gets reported, right, there's a surveillance function that the FDA provides, where they're watching for these kinds of side effects from pharmaceuticals, looking for patterns like this, right?
Yes, prescription monitoring programs, exactly. And physicians are all supposed to report when there's a concern and issues that come up with respect to medication.
Yeah. So let's say that, you know, a couple of these happened, the 19 people got reported through the medical adverse event reporting system, and it ends up and someone finally figures out that what they think they have is a crime on their hands. It then goes to a division that I don't think a lot of people know exists, called the FDA's Office of Criminal Investigation. Can you talk a little bit about who that is?
Sure. You know, the FDA has various components. And one, they have a component that does inspections of facilities to ensure that it has good manufacturing practices that meet FDA standards. But the Office of Criminal Investigation does just what it says. They investigate concerns of potential criminal activity where the person who may have been involved in dispensing or accepting or receiving a product is doing it in a manner that is intended to harm individuals. And so in my prior life, I worked very closely with the Office of Criminal Investigation. And you may be asking, well, how does those cases arrive? And it can arrive from a number of things. I recall sitting at home watching TV one day, and there was a report of something on the news regarding, at that point in time, it was silicon, where someone had actually died because they went to this location to have silicon injected in their thighs, and they got septic and died. And so I called the agent up, and we began investigating, and there were a number of entities that had received this, what we call commercial-grade silicon, which wasn't even suited to be used for human consumption. So it can be the news, and it can be somebody calling the FDA to make a report, and it can be, a lot of times, it was the manufacturer. What is very good about most manufacturers, they have a component that's called a global security, and their function is to monitor and ensure that counterfeit products are not there in the marketplace. And so they will be patrolling, or I should say, monitoring the internet and any other reports of potential counterfeit products. And they will go out, do test purchases, and evaluate the packaging, evaluate the actual drug itself, look at the ingredients, and to ensure that those products are not in fact counterfeit.
So, I'm reminded, by the way, that there are FDA OCI agents who tell me that when they arrest people, sometimes they can't believe that they can be arrested by the FDA, but they do. They carry guns and badges and handcuffs and have the power to arrest you. And what is the so let's walk through the steps. You know, there's a number of people in the hospital, and this reaches FDA and CDC, and the FDA sends, you know, some OCI agents out to interview the people in the hospital, and they sort of figure out, perhaps this is happening right now or has already happened, they figure out that, you know, they were all injected by the same person, you know, in one city, and then they go and they visit that person. And they're basically at that point collecting information, doing interviews, and they're tracing this back to the source, right?
That's exactly right. It reminds me of the 2007 investigation where I mentioned that the physician and his wife were hospitalized. And so there was a concern whether or not there was a tainted batch of authentic Botox, because that's what people thought when they went to the doctor. That's what they told the hospital. But when they were then additional investigations and questioning, they gave the goods up and said, nope, we got this from this source. We got this flyer in the mail that said that this was alternative Botox, although it did say not for human use, for research purposes only. But they thought, no, it was really, you should use it for human consumption. And so a number of physicians received that, and the Office of Criminal Investigation Headquarters sent leads out to, I don't know how many different states, where physicians had actually, they had the invoices showing the physicians had purchased it. The majority actually, when they got it, threw it away because they realized that, no, this can't be a legitimate product. However, there were some that in fact did use it. So you trace that back, and then you also want to go out and talk to the patients of that doctor who actually received it to find out what they were told. In my case, a lot of folks, they thought they had received the authentic Botox. They were shocked. They were dismayed that this trusted physician would betray them and use this product. And so then you want to ensure that they don't have any still on hand, because that's something that we found as well, that they might still have some on hand and they might still be trying to use it. So that's part of the investigation, is to secure and ensure that there's no other product out in the marketplace.
Well, and when they go and talk, let's say in this example, there's some individual out there who injected some of these patients, let's say in Tennessee, and they were sickened, and the OCI agents figure out who it is and they go talk to that person. Probably the first thing they're going to ask is, do you have any of that product left? I mean, if they lie, they've lied to a federal agent, right? That's immediately, they've committed a crime, right?
Yeah, it says 18 U.S.C. 1001, false statement to an agent in a matter that's important to that particular crime. Now, there's a strategy. You know, most agents who've been doing this for a while, it's important to do what? To do the research to kind of size up, to figure out who this provider is, how long they've been practicing. They may get, they may request invoices from the authentic distributor and manufacturer of the product to see whether this physician or provider has actually purchased them. So when they go to ask questions, they already have the trap set.
Yeah, they know the answer before they ask the question. Yes. That's probably the same thing for prosecutors. So if they were to, you know, that process is very interesting to me. So they know that they've got an individual, presumably right now, or they already have, the OCI agents have one or more individuals in mind. They might have already gotten a warrant to search, let's say, their electronic communication to look for invoices or communications with the vendor to figure out where it's coming from. Or maybe they just showed up and started with a search warrant, started searching. Is that typical process?
It depends on the level of information. So in order to get a search warrant, the information, you have to have probable cause to believe that there's evidence of a crime at that facility. And that information must be current, can't be stale. So a lot of times what agents will do is get a subpoena, because that can be issued by the grand jury, or sometimes it can be an administrative subpoena if they have administrative authority. So they'll go and request that information. Typically, the purchasing records, any documents they have concerning that product. They'll want to see their inventory log of any drugs, see what they logged in. They may want to see the registry of patients. So they're in the information gathering mode. Now, sometimes, of course, the suspected provider does not want to provide a statement, and they're not required to. So a lot of times law enforcement tries to, of course, do the element of surprise and see if they will actually talk to them. But on many occasions, they don't. So what they're doing is to collect information, gather information, and then seek to interview others who can help fill in the gaps and put the piece of puzzle together.
So let's say they do this, and you know they've got their Botox administration person who's in a lot of trouble, and they've gathered all the evidence of that, and then they figure out that, and I think we can guess this based on the writing on the vials, that they purchased it from somewhere that is not in the U.S. Right? There's both writing that suggests it could be from Turkey or from China. You know, let's say that this is traced back to an address that was sold and shipped from China. Does that mean that I don't want to say that we're at a dead end for the investigation, but suddenly it becomes much harder for the law enforcement agents to actually chase this down in a different country where they aren't law enforcement agents.
Yeah. So, you know, the first mandate, of course, is to gather information to prosecute someone who's in the U.S. But certainly, as you gather information, you are trying to identify all the individuals who are in the trafficking chain. Now, certain agencies actually have representatives who are stationed in foreign countries. And so they will use their resources and work collaboratively with the law enforcement in that country to continue their investigation. And also the manufacturer, also through their components, which is global security, have employees established in those countries. For example, I work with a lot of pharmaceutical countries that have someone in the North Americas, in Latin America, in Europe, whose job and responsibility was to put together a team to continue to investigate and provide security for their products that are being marketed in that marketplace.
Yeah. And so, I suppose at that point the investigation might split into two, right? The prosecution against the individual who bought it and administered it and hurt patients here would be one thing, but the whole timeline of building a case against somebody in China may just take a lot longer because you don't really have any legal authority. You've got to work in partnership with someone who does.
Well, you bring up a very interesting point because I recall having these conversations specifically when you have health and safety. So you want to, of course, let the investigation run so that you can identify all the individuals involved. But if there's a health and safety point, you have a matter of urgency. So, for example, if you have identified someone who's in the U.S., who's involved in receiving counterfeit product that you suspect came from China, India, I forgot the other countries where there were sourced drugs, you want to try to determine how long you're going to go before you have to shut this down because you are concerned that this person, if he doesn't know he's under investigation, can harm someone. So you want to get information concerning that person's communications. And typically that's going to be, you know, getting information on their email. It's on the phone. You're not going to get anything recent unless you get authority to do a Title III. You can get information that's, you know, 90 days or 75 days old, but it still gives you a picture of who they're communicating with. And we did this in a number of investigations where the agents were able to talk with and meet with the person in the United States, make purchases from that individual based on customers who indicated they purchased it off the internet from this individual, engage that person, make the transactions, get information regarding that person's communications, and then reviewing those records, provide information as to who that person was talking with, and then work that angle all the way back to a foreign country. And yes, you have to get permission a lot of times, so it's good to have relationships with your counterpart in various countries. In order to be effective, when I was the prosecutor, we would try to identify countries where we had good relationships. And when we were near the end of the investigation and we were sure we had sufficient evidence to prove this person was involved, we would strategize how best to have that person travel to that country, if it was not the U.S., have them travel to another country where the law enforcement authorities there agreed to allow us to arrest and would assist us in extradition.
Well, that's an interesting question. So it's possible there are other ways besides, you know, arresting them in that country and then going through the legal process of extradition, which is in and of itself a trial, it appears. There are other ways to get your hands on a criminal who resides in another country to face U.S. justice faster.
It's a long process and there are a lot of hoops and prior approvals, but it can be done. And I did that on a number of occasions. To actually, if it's to bring the person to the U.S., it's called a lure, and you have to go through a lot of approvals through the Department of Justice to lure a foreign national, because, of course, there are a lot of implications with that country, to lure that person to the United States for purposes of arresting them because they have been in violation of our federal laws.
But it is faster, though. If you can get your hands on them here, you can actually bring them into court pretty speedily as opposed to waiting for the other country to give them up.
Well, you know, there's some countries that we don't have extradition treaties with, so we would never get them. So that was a challenge. But then I recall one specific long-term investigation, and it did not involve counterfeit drugs, but it involved counterfeit parts. Apparel. And this individual was connected to, we knew, to the government in a certain country. And we just weren't going to be successful. We had adequate information. We had recordings with this person. we actually had video recordings with this person actually talking about violating the law. And so we had planned to do an extradition, or I should say a lure to a specific country. And we were all ready to travel. And 2 weeks before that, the country called abruptly and said, no, it's not going to happen. And so, and this person was high on the Department of Homeland Security's target list. And so we were successful in working with our counterparts at the Department of Justice, at the attaché's office, and working with another country to restructure that arrangement. And so the person traveled to that country, person was arrested in that country, and we worked on extradition. And I will tell you, sometimes things don't work out. So everything is going fine. And then 2 days later, we get word from the attaché in that country that a magistrate judge called a hearing and gave the person the bond, and they were gone. And we never, we invested a lot of resources in trying to secure that person's arrest. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, it's always stunning to me how much work it is for the good guys to play by the rules to bring the bad guys to justice, and how much less work it is just to do the crime.
Well, I will tell you, I was surprised. Most countries work in a collaborative effort, even if they will not agree to allow their citizen to be extradited to another country. That does not mean that that person may not face consequences there. There's a specific country that I won't mention the name of it, but that country, it wasn't so much the fact that they were engaged so much in counterfeiting. It was the fact that they were not paying their fair share of taxes as a result of the conduct they were in. And that is what got that individual in trouble with that country.
It's always the Al Capone problem. Everybody gets busted for not paying their taxes.
That was it. Yeah.
So we've got patient harm. We've got people in the hospital. We've got OCI investigating. You know, presumably they've got a lead on, or more, one or more leads on the people who did the administration of the Botox and maybe where they got it from. What is the next thing, Sam, that you would expect to see in this case, apart from it spreading to other states? Because I think, as we all know, in a global economy, where people can just go on the internet and buy anything, it seems likely that maybe other people in other states bought this, and we just don't know about the harm that's happened there yet. So what is the next thing you expect that you would see as an announcement as this case progresses?
Well, one thing I want to emphasize, and so, Rami, I want to make sure it's understood that the pharmaceutical industry works collaboratively with law enforcement. Law enforcement cannot be successful without them. And the reason being, in order to ensure that the product is counterfeit, you have to do what? You have to have testing done. And a lot of times, because of the labs and the quantity of work, it can be backed up to get an actual result. What I always liked about the pharmaceutical industry, they could get a result back really quick and a very good report. The report on the actual packaging and a report on the actual dye and how the dye is different from what they would use, the actual font, just the little minute details that you wouldn't ordinarily see that probably OCI's lab may not grab, but they would give a report that was so detailed and helpful that you need that. And so having industry to play a role in helping to identify and confirm that the product is in fact counterfeit is critical. Mm. And timing of the reports is critical.
Yeah. I mean, it is a really great partnership. I work with a number of the brand protection global security teams, and they're all staffed with former law enforcement, which is a great thing. And those guys are out there, you know, they're protecting us, right? They're looking for the counterfeiters, and they're helping build cases to hand over, you know, to law enforcement so they can actually bring them and make them official. And yeah, it's great. So what is the next thing? What would you expect to see?
Yeah, so the next thing is the, well, I call it the dollar signs, ding, ding, ding. So making sure you identify what the bank account, because you also, in addition to being able to secure the arrest, you want to make sure you take away from this person the ill-gotten gains. You want to penalize them, and so seize any money that they acquired and obtained as a result of the illegal activity. So it's critical in your investigation to identify where the money is going. And a lot of times that's how you identify who's all involved, because you can trace the money. Once you've been able to trace the money, then you, as we said, work with the agents who are operating in that country. You determine that where it's coming from, and then there are occasions where you have a manufacturing site in a specific country, which is manufacturing what? The legitimate product. But after hours, they're doing what? They're using the same equipment to manufacture this off-label or counterfeit product, and they use different packaging. So you want to be able to, if you can, trace it all the way back to the source. In one of my investigations, when the product was traced back to the source, that country arrested their nationals, and in the U.S., we were prosecuting individuals in the U.S. So that's kind of part of it. Sometimes you will work with that country, and they will prosecute their citizens who are violating U.S. laws. And their own laws, by the way, in doing this, because it puts everybody at risk. What I found in certain other countries, again, they're concerned with the fact that this is taking away revenue from their economy, and they're not happy about that. So they want everybody to pay their fair share. So once that's done, then you want to know what the bank account is, because what you want to be able to identify how much money this person received. So when you're considering what your charges are, that may play a role in what you end up charging someone with. Specifically, right. Felony versus misdemeanor.
And that's interesting. So if they didn't make enough money, it might be a misdemeanor.
Well, the dichotomy is if they engage in conduct with the intent to defraud and mislead, and showing that they were had a pretty robust operation, they were making a lot of money, that's a good piece of evidence that they were doing it to intend to defraud. They weren't doing it because they were using it for themselves. Most people may not know that with respect to U.S. laws, a lot of people still go across to other countries, Mexico, and get drugs. Bringing drugs in is a violation, but because most of the time it's being done for that person's own personal use, those are not investigated and those are not prosecuted. But when someone is bringing in drugs or distributing drugs with large quantity, that's an indication they're doing it with the intent to defraud and mislead, which is the requirements for felony.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of fascinated by this. This is something we've seen in the Gilead counterfeiting case and others. But the person who the persons who did this committed obviously a criminal offense, right? They made a counterfeit that hurt lots of people and brought it into the U.S. supply chain. But they also committed a civil offense of counterfeiting. They violated trademarks. They passed off a harmful fake that resembles an original. These people are going to end up in a civil trial or civil conflict, as well as a criminal conflict, which sounds to me like it's going to be very expensive.
Maybe so. Exactly.
Ron, do you have like a last thing you want to say?
No, as long as people know that they people can't just enter the supply chain with just any old drug and get by with it. I mean, we have protections now, and that's what we didn't have. We couldn't figure it out before when we just had lot numbers. There were just too many. But now that we can get down to specifics of an item, and we can do recalls on specific items. For example, when a truck load, we had that situation with Eli Lilly, where they broke into their warehouse and loaded up trucks. They were very clever. They actually attempted this three times, two times with not the intent to do anything. And when the police didn't show up the last time, they actually carried it out, broke through the ceiling, and took truckloads away. And we had to recall all of the Lilly product. It happened to be insulin. So as soon as it was out of the warehouse and became not cooled, it was no good. But we had to recall all of it because they couldn't tell us what was there. And so we're just better today. But I'm not sure that solves this problem because it's just not within our grasp to deal with this. This is just completely outside our realm.
Well, that's actually, Ron, you bring up a great point. You know, we have been watching the counterfeit Ozempic problem. And the Ozempic counterfeits that I've seen actually have a single serial number and all the other DSCSA markings on them. And granted, I'm a little weird, but I was very excited because I realized that the recall was not going to be a recall of thousands of units of the same lot. It was going to be a recall of one serial number. There was only one unit of good medicine that might come out of the supply in the process of recalling all these fakes because they all had the same serial number on every box.
Thank you very much.
Well, and that's an improvement, right? Like when you're talking about that theft case, that cargo theft case in the warehouse, like you guys had to recall a lot of good product too that wasn't in the warehouse but had the same lot number because you can't tell one box from the other. And now with serial numbers that are unique, you can.
Yes, we can. Yeah.
So Ron, I remember back in the old days when the pedigrees were being used and they said, look, we got to develop a better process. And the whole conversation and 2010-11 with serialization. You're like, oh, it's going to be so expensive. Oh, it's going to be hard to implement. And it's here. And as you pointed out, very effective and cost savings because now you do not have to implement a recall of all this product. You can now drill down to that particular barcode number.
Well, and I'll tell you guys. Go ahead, Ron.
One of the big improvements that we've had, hospitals have a very hard time with recalls because when a product goes into a hospital, it doesn't go to a pharmacy per se. It goes to a pharmacy and then goes into machines that are automatically filling. It goes into carts that go to floors. And so when you try to do a recall at a hospital, they're really challenged. But if we can say to a hospital, we sold you these serial numbers, go look for them. Now they have something to do. And we can say specifically, we know you have it. So we have this problem in California and the Board of Pharmacy, Jenny and I work very closely. And we actually use three different departments to go out because the Board of Pharmacy couldn't do this. So they used three different organizations. And we found pharmacy not being the problem, but all the other places within the hospital being the problem. And so we just had massive amounts of this product still in the hospital system. And their answer is, hey, we can't do better than that. That's as good as we can do. Now we can do better.
Well, and I'll tell you, I've spent a lot of time talking to people on the Hill about drug shortages and how that drives counterfeits, but it does not do us any good as a country to have to do a recall to protect patient safety and cause an artificial shortage because we took a lot of good product out of the supply to try and find the bad product. And we don't, if the DSCSA does nothing else than prevent artificially driven shortages because of safety recalls, it is paid for itself. Right.
Yeah.
Because nowadays a shortage is not like, oh, I can't get it for a week. Like, we got people looking for products for months. We have treatment being delayed when there's like a manufacturing error, and you know, you shut down the production line for good reason, right? Because you want it to have the high quality products that it puts out. But that, you know, that shortage can really shudder through the system. And so if the system prevents us from having any kind of shortage from a recall for a safety reason, then I think that's a great thing. I think it's a really great thing.
Yeah.
Sam, you want to give us a parting commentary or observation?
This law is only as good as all the stakeholders conform to it. So if we have people who conform to it, we can effectively prevent these counterfeits from infiltrating the legitimate supply chain. So the last parting word is vigilance. We still have to be vigilant. And if we are vigilant and use the statute as it's intended, I think we won't have to worry about Ozempic or Botox or those types of things, even though the counterfeit market is always going to be out there trying to be one step ahead.
Well, I think that means that we're all rooting for the OCI agents who are chasing this down, who are going to protect patients who haven't yet been injected with the fake Botox, and the prosecutors, like all of your former colleagues, who are going to make sure that the people who broke the rules are going to pay a heavy price for it, because I think that deterrence is the only thing that keeps people from deciding to break it more often for financial gain. Thank you, gentlemen, both, for joining me today for so long. It's been a pleasure. I love talking to you both. That's why I love having you on the board. And I look forward to hopefully not another emergency podcast for a counterfeit outbreak for a very long time.
We hope.
All right. Thank you for the Partnership for Safe Medicines. I'm Shabir Saftar. Our guests today have been Sam Lewis and Ron Bone. And tune in, watch our website. We've got a whole tracking page for the counterfeit Botox outbreak, and then a map with the states and examples of previous counterfeit Botox prosecutions and incidents that have happened in the U.S. Thank you for Partnership for Safe Medicines. I'm Shabir Saftar. Have a nice day.